It's Wednesday, October 14, 2020, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly socially distant roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from various places within the Missouri School of Journalism. I'm Amy Simons in the Futures Lab studio here at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. My colleagues, Ernest Perry and Kathy Kiley, are joining me via Skype. Hello to each of you.
Hello.
Hey, I'm in my undisclosed location.
Well, we're glad you're here with us from that place. On our program this week...
I'm immune. I feel so powerful. I'll walk into that audience.
The president says he's going to lay a big fat kiss on everyone at that Florida rally. Several news organizations say they're done sending reporters and photographers on the road to cover events where he and his staff continue to flout the CDC guidelines. Speaking of major news organizations, the New York Times, they're in the process of reviewing one of their most popular podcasts of recent years after the subject of Caliphate was arrested in Canada on charges of perpetuating a hoax. And a man on contract to provide security for employees shoots and kills a man at a demonstration Saturday afternoon. Now the station and its ownership group is in a position to cover the story. There's a lot more that we're going to talk about too before our half hour is up, but we're going to start with the first few days of Judge Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation hearing.
Ranking Member Feinstein and members of the committee, I'm honored and humbled to appear before you today as a nominee for Associate Justice of the Supreme Court.
Ernest, that first day was really nothing but a series of political speeches that were disguised as opening statements. Your impression of what's gone on yesterday and today?
I think what we're seeing is pretty much what we expected. I mean, what I found surprising was that Lindsey Graham pretty much took the time that he had and turned it into a pretty much a political commercial for himself in his battle for to keep his Senate seat in South Carolina. But other than that, I think what we're seeing is pretty much on par with what we expected. The Republicans pretty much said from the beginning that they were going to push this through. And I think Lindsey Graham said that in his opening remarks was that what's going to happen when it reaches when it gets out of committee, when it reaches the Senate floor, is that she's going to be confirmed and that we're going to move on to having her on the Supreme Court before the election.
Kathy, what were some of your thoughts?
Well, I think one of the striking things about this hearing, it's kind of jumping off what Ernest said, the timing of the hearing, the fact that senators are stuck in Washington and a vice presidential candidate at a time when they normally would be out stumping on the campaign trail, I think speaks volumes about what the political situation is in Washington. The fact that Lindsey Graham, who really is very vulnerable, it looks like he could be knocked off. It would be an upset of enormous proportions, but the polls and the fundraising suggest he is vulnerable. The fact that he's in Washington doing this tells you how much the Republicans want to push through this nomination while they have the political advantage. And that means, it's so unusual for a confirmation hearing to be taking place this close to an election. That's the unprecedented thing to me here. And so I think, again, I think it's a reflection of the polarized times and also the concern that the Republicans have that they may lose control of the White House and the Senate.
So talk for a minute about some of that coverage. That isn't necessarily a point of view that we're seeing coming through in the coverage, at least not in the past few days. Why do you think that's missing at this point?
Well, I think there was a lot of coverage of that before you got to the hearings. I mean, the Democrats pretty much talked about that ad nauseum after Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed and President Trump said he was going to immediately have someone nominated and confirmed and on the bench so that they could be on the bench to what he says to basically make sure that the election swings in his way. And he's still saying that almost every day on Twitter. I mean, he has pretty much, as he's done with almost everything else, he's tried to make himself the show even during these confirmation hearings. And so it's almost one of those points where the news media really doesn't have to do a whole lot, because the Republicans have pretty much staked the next 3 weeks on this confirmation and what it means for re-election, not only for the president, but as Kathy said, for senators up and down the ballot.
Well, and so let's talk about Lindsey Graham for one more second, because Kathy, you brought up that he too is quite vulnerable. And Ernest, you brought up the idea that Donald Trump is still kind of sucking all of the air out of the room, especially as it relates to some of those down ballot tickets. Lindsey Graham said some pretty interesting, with the air quotes around it, comments about people of color in the state of South Carolina, where they can go, where they can't. They can go anywhere as long as they're conservative. Some of this is also deflection from him having to answer for some of that. And have we given maybe him a pass on some of those comments? And have they not really deserved the scrutiny or received the scrutiny they deserve?
Well, Go ahead, Kathy.
No, I was just going to say, I think this is a situation where there's so much news coming so fast and furious that it really is difficult, I think, to stop and focus on any one thing. I mean, I think this is the hallmark of the Trump administration era, that there's no time to sit back and think about the implications of the quote that was just uttered, because there's something else coming at you right now. So I think the bet he's making here is that he can campaign as effectively from the chair of the Judiciary Committee as he could if he were stumping out in South Carolina. And I think a lot of what he is doing is trying to appeal to both his base while not totally alienating people who aren't part of that base. But it is an awkward, tricky political maneuver. And Lindsey Graham has always been a person who shoots from the lip. and I think sometimes you're seeing the results.
I mean, when you look at this, I mean, just look at Lindsey Graham in particular. A lot of it is almost acts of desperation. Mm-hmm. He realizes that he knows that he's being overmatched in terms of fundraising. He knows that the polls are going against him. He knows that a lot of people have already voted in South Carolina, and many of those probably weren't voting for him. He's got to keep his base, but he also knows that he has to, as Kathy said, he's got to pull in people now who are still on the fence. And right now, the number of people who are still on the fence is very small.
Okay. Well, tomorrow night, Joe Biden will be doing a town hall on ABC. It was announced this morning on the Today Show that President Trump will be doing a town hall as well, hosted by Savannah Guthrie on NBC. These are both replacements for the canceled second debate. So this is just one of many stops Donald Trump has made this week as he's bouncing around the country, holding rallies like the one Monday night in Florida. And Kathy, we talked a lot about this last week, how his behaviors are putting a lot of working Americans at risk. Now we also see the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and Washington Post say they're done assigning anyone to travel with him. White House Correspondents Association is finding it hard to fill the pool. What's your reaction to some of these moves as someone who's traveled the world with presidents?
Well, I'm not surprised. I mean, I think that, and I think the news organizations are making a good call. It's not like the president's not going to get covered. We've known there's lots of great ways to cover the White House, and sometimes it's from outside the White House is the best way. So you can certainly send reporters to where the president is going, and you don't have to be, as we like to say, in the bubble to do your job. And that may be, it may be healthier, but I mean that in a literal sense, because this White House, as we said last week, has not been accepting of the reality of COVID. And if people are walking around, you know, Air Force One is very close quarters, and people are wandering up and down the aisles without masks. I don't blame the press for not wanting to be part of that. And I would think that at this point in a lot of news organizations, it's almost like going into a combat zone. You're free to say no.
So, Ernest, this does create a sticky situation for a lot of reporters having to choose between covering a major event, kind of like going into combat, which could have significant consequences for our nation, but also protecting their personal health and health of their families. When you talk about going into a combat zone, you don't risk giving a deadly virus to your children or to your parents or to other loved ones. This really does put people in a much tougher position because of the ripple effect that that decision could have.
I mean, I agree with that, but I also, I think Kathy's right. I mean, the press has come up with some pretty ingenious ways of covering this White House in particular, mm-hmm. That doesn't require them to be physically within the bubble, as Kathy said, of what's going on in terms of the White House traveling party. They can still be there. They can be socially distanced. They can have on masks. They can do all the things to try to protect themselves and be able to cover it without being in that situation. But the other thing about what's going on, especially this week, when we were supposed to have the second debate,
yeah.
is that you have both campaigns doing town halls, and Biden had scheduled his immediately after the Presidential Commission on Debates made the decision to cancel. He scheduled his, and then today it was announced that President Trump would have one with NBC, which is quite fascinating. NBC can't seem to get away from Donald Trump on TV, on their network. As we all know, The Apprentice was on their network, and here we go again. And it's like, you know, there's just so much similarities here that you kind of want to go, man, NBC, you're taking a chance again. And people are going to point that out. That is going to be used not only against the president, but it's also going to be used against NBC by some of its rivals,
yeah.
about how this network, whether you're talking about the entertainment side or the news side, can't seem to get away from highlighting or putting Donald Trump, be he the president or be he the reality TV star, on their network.
Kathy, I saw your smile light up when Ernest said that, and the idea of NBC not getting away from Donald Trump and giving him that space and that time on the air. Do you think on any level that it could also be about NBC News trying to somewhat separate itself or provide some level of balance to the left-leaning punditry that's on MSNBC?
Well, you know, if you have a chance to get the president on the air, mm-hmm. You're probably going to say yes. I think, though, that the thing you need to point out, or that we need to point out, yeah. is that while the commission on the presidential debates was the one that ultimately pulled the plug, it was because Donald Trump said he would not debate and do it virtually. Mm-hmm. He would not do what we are doing right now, which is have a conversation at a social distance. And remember, this was supposed to be a town hall debate, so Biden scheduled a town hall, and now Trump wants back in the game. We're really seeing a lot of this where the president first says he doesn't want to negotiate with Congress he's not going to negotiate on a COVID relief package until after the election. And then a day or two later, or maybe an hour or two later, he changes his mind. So the same thing happened here. And I think the question for the network is, are you enabling when you allow him to, after having sort of blown up the debate that was supposed to take place, allow him to reschedule? And again, I think it's a difficult call. I mean, he is the president of the United States, mm-hmm. but I do think he is now getting to do something his way, as opposed to complying with the rules that were established by the commission.
Okay, so we're talking about safety of reporters. We spend so much of our time looking east to Washington, D.C. I want to look west towards Denver and spend a few minutes talking about what's been happening there. You might have seen the photo from two protests on Saturday captured by a Denver Post photojournalist, a woman named Helen H. Richardson. There's one man shooting pepper spray, the other pointing a gun.
What happened on Saturday played out in a matter of seconds.
The man fell on the ground. You know, it was...
The gravity of what Brian Loma witnessed still hard for him to grasp.
Man's life was lost.
Loma was streaming the dueling rallies with so-called patriots and BLM supporters when he says he heard a loud argument between the library and art museum.
No, I saw what looked like a punch, and then there was a gas, and there was a shot.
Denver police rushed past Bryant, ordering the man with the gun to get on the ground. Patriot member he shot, laying feet away, would later be pronounced dead.
So the voice of the reporter that you just heard there is WFAA's Jason Whiteley reporting from Dallas on behalf of Denver's 9 News. And that's because Matthew Dolloff, the man with the gun, was hired to be a 9 News security guard at those protests. So let's start with the shooter who was hired by the station to provide security. Kathy, how often does this happen, that news outlets will hire security guards and armed security guards at that?
Well, it's very unusual. It was very unusual. It's become less unusual, I would say, since 2016. Prior to the last presidential election, really the only time news organizations hired security guards was when they were sending reporters into places like Iraq. But then with the 2016 election, I remember I was an editor for Bloomberg at the time, and one of my colleagues, someone you know from Chicago, John McCormick, was telling me he couldn't go to Iowa this particular weekend because they were expecting a big verdict in a Chicago case and there might be riots. And so he said, boy, they've issued us bulletproof vests and the whole bit. And I said, John, I think you should keep that vest and take it with you to Iowa. And he kind of laughed, and I said, I'm not kidding, because I was concerned about not so much the rhetoric from Donald Trump himself, because I think to the president, or I'd like to think, then the candidate, for Donald Trump, that's a shtick. You know, it's he likes to target reporters. It gets the crowd riled up. But it's the people in the crowd, some of whom might be hearing voices through their teeth fillings. You know, that's the people I'm worried about, the people who will hear those words and act on them. And so I think since 2016, you've seen, and as I say, I was one of them, more editors getting concerned about the safety of reporters. And that is what's led to this very tragic situation.
The person's qualifications are also and background are also being called into question. He was not licensed to be a security guard in the state of Colorado. That has led to some questions maybe about the responsibility, potential negligence on the part of 9 News in hiring him. The station, Ernest, has made the decision not to cover the story itself and to rely on a sister station within the Tegna ownership group, clearly in an effort to separate itself and provide transparency. In your opinion, does asking the WFAA newsroom to cover it on its behalf go far enough to do that?
You know, these uncharted waters, I would say that they are sort of trying to figure this out. And I do think that it's good for them to have one of their other stations under another news director and another desk to handle the story. That way they are showing transparency, because this other and also saying this is why we're doing this. Mm-hmm. Plus, I mean, they're definitely going to be some legal issues coming through this, both on the civil and the criminal side. So I'm pretty sure that there were lawyers involved that says, hey, there are certain things that we're going to need to do, or you're going to need to stand down, because many of you may be called either in a criminal case or a civil case to provide testimony. So it's best that you separate yourselves from this situation right now. So I think right now they're probably following not only the transparency issues as it relates to journalism, but also the legal issues as it relates to the case.
And it's kind of interesting. We talked about the creativity, the ingenuity, the innovation that has gone into creatively covering the president without being physically in the same place. This is possible because of all of the experimentation that had to be done using remote and socially distant reporting is a result of the pandemic, that they're even able to report on this story and cover it as closely as they are from states away.
Yeah, my guess is that they're probably using freelance photographers and freelance journalists within the Denver area to cover that, and then they're sending their material directly back to WFAA in Dallas, and they're doing it in that regard. I mean, you know, just to point out some of the things that Kathy was talking about, yeah. I've covered my share of protests and unrest after verdicts several times, and I never really felt as if I needed to have armed guards. Now, I was concerned about my photographer, and I was concerned about the journalists, in particular the television journalists, because having that camera does make you a target. I was a newspaper reporter, so I could sort of blend in. And
your tools were a pen and a notebook. You weren't carrying absolutely. A camera that...
Right.
Yeah.
And so that's an issue.
There's a fascinating piece on our links blog from the New York Times that has and talks about what some might call the money shot, that showdown between the two men. But you don't see that in any of the Denver Post's online work. Kathy, talk for a minute about the considerations that need to be made when you have a photo that sensitive in the content and that explicit. How does proximity kind of play into the decision making when you publish a photo like that and when you hold it back? Maybe put it on a wire for someone else to use.
Yeah, well, obviously, in Denver, Colorado, there are people who would know the victim mm-hmm. and family members. So I do think, you said it, Amy, proximity is everything here. So I think, you know, newspapers and news organizations are part of the communities in which they exist. And you have to have some sensitivity to that. So I think there's always a balancing act. In this case, there may be some legal considerations too. We just don't know. But I do think oftentimes a photo that's that gut-wrenching, an editor could reasonably say, this is something this particular community does the public really need to see this?
Okay. So let me ask you this one. What is it that they say about a story that's too good to be true? The New York Times is finding itself in the hot seat after the main subject, that central compelling character of its hugely popular podcast, Caliphate, was arrested in Canada and charged with perpetuating a hoax. Kathy, fill us in on all the details here.
Well, you know, I'm having flashbacks because I was at USA Today when we were confronted with a very similar situation. And
back in 2004.
It really reminds me. We found out that one of the reporters who had been a star traveling reporter was making things up. And as in that situation, from what we're reading, the New York Times brass had plenty of warnings from its beat reporters. So the idea here was that this reporter who created the podcast had these amazing interviews with this Canadian jihadist who talked in very gruesome, grisly detail about atrocities he had committed. And, you know, it was reportorial gold, so much so that some of the other reporters were questioning it. Now, I think sometimes bosses can hear what they want to hear and can dismiss concerns as professional jealousy. But I think what we learned at USA Today, and I think may be the case here, but there were a succession right around the time of USA Today's problems. There were a succession of cases, one at the New York Times with Jason Blair, one at the New Republic with Stephen Glass, and then USA Today and Jack Kelly. And all three of those cases had a common thread, which is that none of those were beat reporters. They were not people who had to go back to the same well over and over again. And if you are a beat reporter and you have to do that, if you make a mistake or misquote somebody, you better correct it or people are going to stop talking to you. So it's a kind of self-enforcing, virtuous cycle The problem today is that with the macroeconomics of the news business, there are fewer and fewer beat reporters. Mm-hmm. So if you're parachuting in and you're just one and done on a particular topic, it's a lot easier to cut corners and start getting away with things. And the experience I had at USA Today suggested that it's a slippery slope. One little exaggeration leads to another and another, and the New York Times story is sounding eerily familiar.
Okay, well, before we go, one last thing I want to touch on.
The news may be good or bad. We shall tell you the truth.
When The Voice of America went on the air in Germany on February 1st of 1942, it made that promise to tell the truth. Now, five former officials are accusing the government agency's CEO of manipulating that truth and using it to spread a pro-Trump agenda abroad. I gave myself a tongue twister there. Kathy, I wanted to ask you more about this last week. We didn't have time, and since you and I first talked about it just the littlest bit, there has been a lawsuit filed. Catch us up.
Well, the Voice of America, since June, when it got a new executive director, has been in complete upheaval. There have been dozens of reporters who are foreign reporters recruited by Americans because of their language skills to broadcast into their home countries where free speech is at a premium. They have been told their visas are not likely to be renewed. So it's almost like leaving the translators behind in Afghanistan. You're kind of betraying people who have been helping to spread America's message. And then there have been these huge funding withholdings, I would say. There's one organization within the Office of Government Media, U.S. Office of Government Media, that actually creates apps and tools for democracy activists to use. And this new director, who is a Trump and Steve Bannon ally, has been withholding money from it. So it's there are even Republicans, very conservative Republicans, who are upset about this because they see it as undermining America's mission throughout the world and undermining our soft power internationally.
So, Ernest, talk for a second about how we can keep this as something that our audience, our listeners, would be interested in. They hear Voice of America and maybe eyes glaze over because that isn't a product that is legally available to us here.
And I think that's part of the issue here is that here in the United States, we don't know a lot about Voice of America because it is one of those governmental entities that is meant to be used outside of the country. And thus, we have an issue in terms of being able to understand what this issue is about and try to help to keep this entity alive.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, both of you. We are just about out of time for this week. I would like to thank everyone for spending the last half hour with us today. You can read more about each of the topics that we talked about. You can watch some of those videos and audio that we also played within this program. You can see that on our links blog. That's reachable under both the programs and podcast tabs on kbia.org. We are also available wherever you get your podcast downloads, including iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @views on KBIA. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave comments and questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next time, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and Aaron Hay for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.